What happened to EdTech?
We've seen crazy valuations, crazy sales, crazy revenues. Suddenly, all went down close to zero.
Mversity is changing the education system by bridging the gap between university education and industry-needed skills, leading to higher employability in high-demand sectors like healthcare and hospitality.
What is the model? What is the intent? What do they get out of it? Why is it better for the students? And why is it better for the employer?
We act as a bridge between academia and the industry by creating those linkages. In our model, when a student is already a part of the higher education system and getting upskilled through Mversity in that process, the student actually doesn't pay anything extra.
What is a good education business to build?
Somebody asked a question to me, how does the future of higher education and skilling look like? It is neither online nor offline, it is on job.
There is this dichotomy of so many students unemployed. Why that dichotomy exists in the first place?
Because over time, our higher education or universities hasn't kept pace with what are the demands of the industry.
Now, universities and colleges are not geared to create job-ready candidates. How are they going to train these people? On a blackboard?
One of the key reasons why we got attracted to Mversity was people get 2 years of on-the-job training. Which university did that?
So higher education in India is a $70 billion market. As of today, there are about 40 million students enrolled in more than 45,000 higher education institutes. And every year, about 20 million people come out of these colleges and higher education institutes. Most of them are unemployable.
What does success look like in 10 years?
See, there are both long-term and near-term lenses. I think...
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Zero to Infinity. We've got an exciting one for you today. We talk about the rise and fall of EdTech. We talk about education and we talk about employability. Right? Fortunately for us, we've got great, I've got great companions with me on this podcast. I'm joined by Mr. Vivek Sinha, who is founder and CEO of Mversity. Prior to this, he was COO at an academy, so not a stranger to this side of the town at all. Hi Vivek, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Rajat. Thank you, CV, for having me.
We're also joined by Rajat, who has been, exposed to EdTech from an investor lens. He's seen many, many phases, which I'm hoping he'll take us through. Excited to have you on board.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Fantastic. Let's start. I will start with the toughest question first. What happened to EdTech? We've seen crazy valuations, crazy sales, crazy revenues. Suddenly, all went down close to zero. We've seen several models, a K-12 model, a NEET model. We've seen a kindergarten model, and now all of them marked down significantly. So let's start there. What happened to EdTech?
So see, I think let's take a segment by segment view, because the challenges with each of the three or four segments within EdTech were different. So if I oversimplify, let's break down EdTech into three segments. One is a daycare segment, wherein a parent just want their kids to be engaged. So think of a math class or an online computing class or hobby classes. So put all that in the daycare bucket. The other segment was, I would say, let's call it tournaments or high stake games, which is test preparation, where the, let's say the outcome is like completely changes the trajectory of your life. And the third segment is the regulatory product, which is schools and colleges. Now, the most boring segment of all is actually the regulatory product segment, schools and colleges, where most people did not actually build. They wanted to, in fact, disrupt schools or colleges and build outside it. So if we talk about the test prep segment first, the test prep has a very fundamental issue that TAM is not a growing segment. I mean, the number of test takers in India is not above 20-30 lakh if you combine all categories in general. Add to that because it is such a high stakes exam, legacy matters a lot. You don't get another shot at taking, let's say, the JEE exam or a CAT exam. So there is a natural amount of inclination towards legacy player compared to the, let's say, new age or online players. Now, if a lot of money is flowing into that small TAM of 20, 30 lakh or 40 lakh test taker, that TAM itself is not growing. The TAM is getting dominated by, let's say, the legacy player. So I think that created a fundamental issue where beyond a certain point, most of the edtech players weren't able to grow. If you talk about the daycare segment, so online maths class, computing class, hobby classes, I would say that is the simplest segment to achieve initial traction, because all it requires is building content and then marketing. So that's a content plus marketing game. Barrier to entry is the least. Anyone can build content, especially in the age of AI, it's become even more simple, and it's a performance marketing campaign optimization game. So you build traction early on, but later on you realize that outcomes are not very clear in that segment, and hence you face two challenges. First is retention. The revenue that you get by the virtue of spending, you are not able to retain or hold on to that revenue. And then of course, your unit economics stops making sense, because your sales and marketing goes up to half of your revenue. Theoretically, that TAM is infinite. Theoretically, you can sell a $5.99 subscription to everyone in India. But that was a challenge in that segment.
So Vivek, on this point, I remember you telling me that the emotion that people don't talk about enough in that segment is motivation. I think that's a great point. You want to just highlight that for the audience?
Yeah. See, for education to work, I think the biggest metric or the most important metric is intent. So in test prep, the reason why it works for, there's a TAM issue, but the reason why test prep work is that an average learner knows that without going for a coaching, it's almost impossible to crack JEE, NEET, CAT, or one of these competitive examinations. So the intent is super high in test prep. Similarly, in the regulated product segment, schools and colleges, the intent is super high. Think of COVID when people lost jobs. Discretionary spend, if you look at consumer as a portfolio, what would be the last expenditure that you cut in your household P&L? School or colleges? Bachcho ko school se to nahi nikaloge na. So the intent is again very high in the regulatory product segment. The intent is least in the discretionary product segment, which in this case is the daycare product. If you take Baiju for example, I think the initial product tablet was great. The only issue is when a parent sees that the kid has stopped using that tablet or that subscription, the parent is not going to renew it, because it's not a mandatory product. So yeah, across all three categories that I spoke of, intent defines which category will get, let's say, greater learner traction.
Yeah. So it's building on that. It's one is intent, but also it's outcomes, right? Like India, the overall education market is probably hundreds of billions of dollars, probably 130, 140 billion when I last looked at it. And bulk of that, to Vivek's standpoint, goes to formal education, which is colleges, schools. And there also your ability to differentiate by providing outcomes results in people choosing one over the other. And that's true globally, right? People go to Stanford or Harvard or wherever, and their fees has gone crazy over a period of time because they are still generating outcomes. Now in the edtech sector globally and in India, where were the outcomes? At a certain scale it worked, but as soon as people try to expand it, it's just been incredibly hard to deliver outcomes, partly because of format, partly because of what the individual company was doing. And our belief is that education is one of the core things that any human deserves and should get. And if you don't deliver outcomes after taking a child through several years or several months of it, then it's almost criminal in a way. And hence, we are very excited about something which solves the problem for the student actually, right? And the other ecosystem players. If you don't solve the problem, don't deliver outcomes, then the results will be what they have been.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. So I'm going to marry both of this together. Intent matters and outcome matters. And like you're saying, outcome is kind of subjective in the tuitions market, right? You're kind of going for a tuition. Sometimes you log into the app, not sure what your final grades are. There's an extra tuition teacher. Somebody teaches you at home, etc. On NEET as well, from the outcome perspective, by definition, a small percentage of them will end up cracking it. And that's the test prep market's problem. Which brings us to the outcome that actually matters, right? And it comes down to employability. So I want to shift the conversation to what Vivek mentioned as the regulatory side of things, right? So schools, colleges, etc. For colleges, it's even more clearer in terms of outcomes, right? It brings me back to an earlier discussion that the three of us had. But before we get there, Vivek, you'd been part of the tournament market in some form in your definition, right? And you came out with the same thesis on intent matters, outcome matters. How did you get to what to build now? Because anything in edtech you kind of had in some form played. And now you decide to say, you know what? EdTech probably shouldn't exist in the way that it exists at all. So take us through your...
This EdTech we should stay away from. Right? It's, the title of the podcast is also anti-EdTech. I think there are good businesses and bad businesses. We have to figure out a way to build a good business. And I hope we are in one. I think we are in one. So yeah, let's just...
Let's start there. What is a good education business to build?
The answer is not very different compared to what it is for any good business in general. First of all, it should solve a very, very real need, right? So the way we zeroed down on Emversity was that we thought that solving for the issues in the labor marketplace is a very, very meaningful problem to focus on. I mean, we talk about our demographic dividend, and every year about 20 million people come out of these colleges and higher education institute, and we know the state of employment, right? I mean, most of them are unemployed, but the bigger problem is that most of them are unemployable. So forcefully they have to become part of the informal labor force, and we take a lot of pride in the fact that people coming out of colleges are working as Uber driver and let's say delivery boys and earning 30,000 rupees. But actually that's, the system has done injustice to those people because they spent 16 years acquiring education. So first was that we thought that it's a meaningful problem to solve. Second, of course, we also realized that it's a very huge problem that needs to be solved. So higher education in India is a $70 billion market. As of today, there are about 40 million students enrolled in more than 45,000 higher education institutes. So the definition of a higher education institute is either a college or university. So there are 45,000 players in the market, incumbents if you want to call it, right? And together they clock $70 billion across 40 million learners. But if you leave aside the top 2 or 3% of the colleges and university, or the top 2, 3% of the programs, let's say 20 lakh, 10 lakh engineering seat, 3 lakh medical seat, and 3-4 lakh MBA seats and professional courses. So, baki 1 crore 90 lakh logo ka kya hota hai? What happens to the other 19 million people? So, we thought that we should build for that segment. Third is, of course, a good edtech business is, which is also viable and sustainable. One of the challenges that the early, of course, there were category related challenges that we discussed, but in the era of excess, that was 2020 or 2021, there was also mindset issue about, this whole mindset of disrupting education. I feel education is a service business, and disruption, hints at ego. So education requires a very different approach to build. It requires a more patient approach, in my opinion, because here you can't build trust in weeks. It takes years to build trust. But once the good part is once you build trust, then it's exponential. So, we also zeroed down on business model which we believed will scale, will become large. Second, it will create real, tangible, measurable outcomes for our learners. And third, which will also be viable and sustainable at a unit level.
Yeah.
So, for us, and of course, the fourth lens would be where we can make a meaningfully better business using technology. So I think all these four boxes checked in case of skilling and higher education as a segment in India for us.
So I want to come back to the model, but before that, Rajat, I want to throw a question at you around what there is this dichotomy of so many students unemployed, and we've seen across our portfolio as well that you just don't get good talent, right? So maybe take us through why that dichotomy exists in the first place, and what's the outcome side of the equation in some form, right?
So, if you talk to not just the startups, but actually the broader industry in India, this whole issue of employability of workforce is a clear problem, because for good or for bad, over time, our higher education or universities haven't, or an average university at least, hasn't kept pace with what are the demands of the industry.
Yeah.
So if they're not teaching the student, then how will even outcomes even happen, right? And then that's where lots of large companies actually run their in-house training programs, which honestly is not that industry's or the company's job.
Yeah.
It's the university or the education institute's job to actually give them good people. But that's just been very hard for a variety of different reasons, right? And it's just legacy industries, and they've not kept pace. Teachers are underpaid, and so many different issues, which actually we like a lot in what Vivek is trying to do. That one of the key reasons why we got attracted to Mversity was all of the stuff that they're doing is industry backwards. Some of the programs are co-designed or co-created with the actual companies. And others are just the curriculum, the way of teaching, everything is industry backward. People get 2 years of on-the-job training. Which university did that? Like, I went to IIT, I got like 6 months of industrial training, or maybe 3 months of industrial training, which is just not enough in my mind.
Yeah. So let's get into that, right? So what is the Mversity model? We've talked about intent, which means the student inherently has to be motivated to complete the course. We've talked about outcome, which in this scenario is a job, right? It's as simple as a job, right? So Vivek, take us through the model here. What is the model? What is the intent? What do they get out of it? Why is it better for the students? And why is it better for the employer?
So I'll build on where Rajat left. He made a point that about on-job learning. So I think in 2023, I started thinking, and somebody asked a question to me, how does the future of higher education and skilling look like? Is it online or is it offline? And the first thought that came to my mind was that either it is neither online nor offline, it is on job. And I think that was, if I have to like go back and pick up a very core and fundamental insight around which we built the whole company, it was this insight that the future of skilling is neither online nor offline, it's on job. So talking about Mversity, see, as I said, there are more than 45,000 incumbents in the higher education play. And they are doing a good job in terms of building an academic foundation for the students. But what the industry needs is much more beyond the regular academic foundation. They require people to be job ready on day one, in short, if I can put it. Now, universities and colleges are not geared to create job ready candidates.
Can you make that real? Can you take a sector and maybe make it real for us?
Okay. Let's take nursing for an example. There is a procedure called intubation. It's a life-saving procedure that one has to perform on a patient. A nurse which comes out of a four-year bachelor's degree program in nursing has learnt intubation, but how? The instructor has written, let's say, the 5 or 6 steps that is required to perform intubation on the blackboard. That nurse will someday have to perform that procedure on a real patient in real life environment, right? That's the issue.
It's shocking that some of them have never even met a live patient.
Yeah, we did some interviews, they'd never met patients.
So even the best of the colleges, and I'm talking about the best nursing colleges where you actually have to go to class, where there are actual instructors, I'm talking about the best one. How are they going to train these students? On a blackboard? Now, what we do at Mversity is that we empower these higher education institutions and help them build industry linkages. So we revamp their whole curriculum using technology, using our proprietary content. B, we invest in enhancing their skill lab infrastructure. So we help them in building high fidelity simulators inside their premises. We help them in building virtual reality simulation labs in their premises so that people learn not on blackboard, but by practicing these procedures on mannequins and in the virtual world. But finally, we also embed industry integration in their course. And these are credit bearing, let's say, industry integration. This is not a top up on the degree. So if the student spends 20 or 30% of their time
as a part of the course, performing what they have learned in the skill labs, performing the same procedure in an actual environment, if I take nursing for an example. So that's what we do. We act as a bridge between academia and the industry by creating those linkages.
So we've spoken about the students' need to get jobs and be better educated, which gets solved through industry-linked content, innovation in how content is delivered, how the on-job training happens. The industry which actually ends up employing them is clearly benefited because they get job-ready people on day one. But it's also the university, which is a very integral part of what the university model is. The universities that we are partnering with suddenly find this a way to differentiate themselves from the others. They are offering a much better value prop versus, you know, the next door university. And their students are just coming out better, getting jobs, which enables overall how the ecosystem works. So I think this, the fact that Vivek has been able to stitch together a model which provides value to each and every stakeholder, while actually in the process making very good margins on the university business as well, is probably very unique and incredible to see.
So I want to break down that. So there are three stakeholders: the students, the university, and the employer, right? When we initially started off and there was a business model choice on which student and which employer, right? And I think primarily everybody either makes the leap of faith that we just need more engineers, right? Let's just teach people coding. Let's teach them AI, right? And we'll get them into an Infosys or a Wipro or whatever,
Flipkart or
something like that. And I think that model on paper is kind of attractive because your ticket size is a lot more. The student is ready to pay for the degree. Technically, you've got a white collar job and it's fancy, right? But Vivek, you had a very strong pushback to say that's not the segment that needs innovation. That's not where the gap is. And the gap is actually in skills. The gap is actually in gray collar. The gap is actually folks who may be pushed and forced to do a job as a delivery boy may actually have a better career path, right? So walk us through how you came to the decision on which segment to build this in.
So there were three important design choices that we took early on in our journey. So first was about industry. So we said that we will solve for talent gap only in industries where we can see clear secular growth for the next two or three decades. So, I mean, if you are a you guys are a believer in the 2047 India growth story. So, what is going to propel the growth of, let's say, India at a 7-8% GDP growth year on year? It's the core infrastructure sector, the nation building sector. So, where is capacity going to get added? Is going to get added in healthcare, it's going to get added in manufacturing, it's going to get added in construction, it's going to get added in tourism and hospitality. Yeah. So these are the four or five sectors that we are long on and we picked. The second design choice, we deliberately did not pick up technology because I think there the issue is different. Then there are segments in technology. At the higher end of the spectrum, there is oversupply. Technology or management. And at the lower end of the spectrum, I think the employers are doing a great job. So there the onus on skilling is on a Wipro or a TCS or an Infosys.
Absolutely.
And they don't need a external skilling partner. They have taken the onus on themselves. Anyways, so first choice was industry choice. Second choice was role choice. We said we are not going to do white collar jobs. White collared, honestly, there is oversupply. Take management or technology, for example. As you rightly said, you have a very high ticket size over there. I can launch a new age MBA school and charge 25 lakh rupees. I just have to do 400 students in order to clock a thousand crore revenue or 100 crore revenue. But that's the ISB model. Even ISB has the best brand in the country has not been able to scale beyond one or two campuses. So there everyone is going to hit a roadblock because there's oversupply in the market. We also decided not to do blue-collared. There is infinite TAM in the blue-collared segment, but monetization is incredibly hard.
Plus, in the blue-collar segment, people do not have the luxury to spend a lot of time in upskilling themselves, yeah, because there is a pressure on them to be a part of the labor force as soon as possible and start contributing to the family income. So we picked a segment that we define as gray-collared, between the white-collared and the blue-collared. So gray-collared is anyone who has received a technical training of 2 or 3 years, but doesn't have a desk job, not a knowledge worker. So think, let's say, in a hospital environment, we don't do ward boys, we don't do doctors, we do nurses. In, let's say, construction as an environment, we don't do engineers, we don't do plumber, fitter and carpenter in blue-collared. We are going to do site supervisors, quantity surveyors, planning engineers, and so on and so forth. The third choice that we had to take was of the model itself. Think of this as a labor marketplace, where on one side of the marketplace there are employers, on the other side of the marketplace there are students or candidates. Who do I monetize? So if you look at the evolution of EdTech in India, and Rajat will tell you this, the bootcamp model has never worked in India. So after you have already spent 16 years acquiring an education or that's a degree in India, and then if somebody comes and tells you, hey, whatever you studied for the last 16 years is nonsense, now my 1 year program is going to get you your dream job, that model doesn't work in India. Because here, by that time you are already out of, let's say, the education system, you have to be a part of the labor force as soon as possible. Yeah. So we decided to take our offering inside the education system, not after them. That was one important design choice. And the second design choice was to monetize the supply side of the marketplace, not the demand side. If you look at corporates in India in healthcare, hospitality, etc., if you look at their L&D budgets, that's hardly anything. Yeah. So it would have been extremely difficult to monetize, at least in this market, the demand side.
I think it also comes back to intent. If the student is paying for their degree and they believe there is value in that degree, which they're coming out of their wallet for, then it just maximizes their intent. They're going to get a degree out of it. They're going to get their money's worth out of it. I know you've got an interesting spin on that, to say they're actually getting paid while they're studying as well.
So I'll tell you, CV, a lot of us founders complain that building in India is very hard. There are no AOVs, no margins. I think that's a very lazy take about building in India. So, let's say, I was saying, even in skilling, it's incredibly hard to ask money from a student who has already gone through 16 years of education. It's very hard to ask the employers. So one may take a simplistic view that skilling business nahi ban sakta.
Yeah.
But I'm saying what we did was, in our model, when a student is already a part of the higher education system and getting upskilled through Emversity in that process, the student actually doesn't pay anything extra. In fact, the student pays lesser compared to what he or she was paying for their regular college education, because the work integration part actually also give them stipends during the course of the program.
Yeah.
In our flagship program in hospitality, for example, that's a partnership that we did with Taj. So the fee for the degree program is 3.6 lakhs. And during those 3 years of degree program, the student gets back 3.6 lakhs. So effectively, it's zero cost to pursue a degree. So I think, yes, it is hard to build in India if you take a very, very simplistic view. But as founders, it's our job to find out models which work for both sides of the marketplace.
Actually, that business model innovation that Vivek and the Emversity team has done was probably very unique. The fact that students are getting paid while they earn, while they learn, crashes the cost so much that it becomes a, and on top of that, you actually get them jobs when they pass out and internships while they are studying, makes this such an interesting value proposition for the student. That Vivek, I think now your acquisition is 50% organic or referral, or in that zone, that. More than that, right? Which education business in India or anywhere in the world has that? And that is such, because the value prop has been cracked in such a meaningful way, that the business model architecture becomes very interesting from a VC's lens, right? That despite choosing that gray collar segment, which theoretically cannot pay, you are still able to architect a business model which is interesting. And for us as VCs, like we've you know, go on record to talk about how digital nation building and nation building in general is an important value for us or important goal for us. I think this, again, if there is any company in our portfolio which is trying to get there, it's Embercity, and that's very exciting for us.
Yeah.
That there is an ability to have impact at scale, truly builds the nation brick by brick. And while doing that, builds a great business. I think what else can we see us?
Yeah. I think anecdotally, I've had the pleasure of interviewing your students and your parents as well. And it's really heartening to see that it is actually life-changing for a lot of them, right? I've heard stories where their parents came from a very modest background. Maybe they were plumbers, some of them were carpenters. And for them to be able to place their kids into a hospital OT, or a Taj or Lemon Tree, right? I could just see it in their eyes that we are doing something that makes a difference and that propels us. But here's the contrast to that view as well, right? And I want to bring that up. People aren't mixing tech with education and making it ed tech because it is quote unquote nice to hear. It is also because education is tough to scale. Right, and you're talking about massive scale. When you say developed nation building, it's millions of people. And whenever Vivek talks about his IPO ambitions, which are very scary, he like it's 30, 40, 50,000, like lots of students that you have to educate. And it's a real, like you said, services business. So what is this leverage to the scale here? Like, how do you just scale this business?
Yeah, I think that's a pertinent point because you see, theoretically, if you are building a pure play tech business, then at least in theory, there is operating leverage in that business.
Yeah.
I mean, all of you would have heard stories about how one of my educator in an academy was getting a $2 million salary.
Yeah.
At least in theory, that $2 million salary made sense because effectively, if I'm paying lakh rupee an hour to that educator, that class is streamed to or can be streamed in theory to millions of learners.
Yeah.
Now, the moment you have investment in physical infrastructure as well, apart from digital only infrastructure, to some extent, those operating leverages, those obscene operating leverages go away. And hence, building a business like Embercity is also a matter of discipline. This will be a very steady and high compounding business, but this won't be that kind of a business, what at least in theory, an academy or a Baiju could have been. Which means that execution layer also becomes as important as the idea or the product selection. So great, the problem statement identification and the product design choices are awesome. But as you scale, execution, discipline and rigor becomes important. So two, three things, unit economics. Where technology helps me is in achieving a 40% center level EBITDA, which would not have been possible without leveraging technology. Without leveraging technology, we would have been a 20-22% center level EBITDA, which is not bad by any stretch of imagination, but then it's a offline business.
Yeah.
So I achieve consumer internet margins because I am able to leverage technology. Now that happens in two, three ways. A, bringing down my distribution cost structure, and Rajat mentioned that 50% of our traction is referrals, but the other 50%, I think hardly 8 or 9% of my traction is paid marketing. The other 50% is through a career counseling platform that we have built that drives, you know, lakhs of learners on our platform, which eventually get converted into a paid product. Second, because it is not a proper product business, it is a service business. How do you standardize and scale service? That's where technology comes into picture. So that the quality of program that you get in Srinagar is the same as the quality of program for that particular module in Thrissur. By the way, we have center in both Thrissur and Srinagar, and that's why I was giving that example. So I think that's one lens where technology can actually empower you. But there are other two lenses which are purely related to how you manage the business. So first, discipline of new vertical launch. As a company, we always feel that we should earn the right to launch new cohorts or new programs.
Yeah.
So for the first 1.5 years, we only did healthcare. We had the ambition, we had the experience and operating capability. We had the money in bank, but we focused only on healthcare, and that too only on two specific program choices within Allied Health. We scaled only when we saw traction. We launched hospitality with Taj with a very small cohort of 100 people. When we saw great NPS and when we saw great outcomes in that cohort, that's when we decided to scale up hospitality. Third and the foremost, as I said, is unit economics. I said that our centers on an average makes, let's say, 40% EBITDA. If my CAC goes up from 11% what it is today of the revenues to, let's say, 16%, zyada nahi, 5%. If I overpay the rent as a cost of on my P&L, let's say if it is 7% today, if it goes to 9%, zyada nahi hai, 2% ka difference hai. If I overpay my staff, 12% to 14%, if in each line item, all this adds up and I become a 20% EBITDA business from a 40% EBITDA business.
Yes.
So, rigor and execution discipline is also what matters in our kind of business.
I will also add, you know, they've done a fantastic job in my mind of embedding technology in very smart ways. So people say EdTech is online education and all of that. I think they've demonstrated what EdTech should be, which is actually using technology to improve your funnels. It's incredible how they are one of the best use cases, at least in our portfolio, where I've seen where they're using voice AI effectively to on funnel management for new new users. How they're using VR, I don't see anyone else using VR actually, and it's not just for show. You could walk into any university classroom and you will see VR being used to deliver education outcomes.
Yeah, we masquerade like a boring offline play, but I think we are more tech than any
inside the classes.
Under the hood, we are more tech than in any other.
Their CRM or their LMS or use of smart classrooms, they just got everything, but it's delivered in a in situ inside a university. So it delivered in an offline campus. And that's where I think both education and technology come together in perhaps the most meaningful way for me.
Yeah. So what does success look like in 10 years? I know Vivek has a Excel file that he's going to pull up. But
no, you would have written down already. This is what will happen 10 years later.
But not 10 years, choose a time frame. But I think the reason I want to bookend that conversation is to say, it's a very, very large, unsolvable goal. Like technically, it's unsolvable, right? It's an employment problem. It's a skill problem. The numbers are huge. And hence, to make a real dent.
No, but Stevie, I'll add that. The numbers seem crazy, but actually, Vivek will have that. How many students study at a lovely professional university every year?
The intake is 30,000.
30,000 students,
wow.
One university does.
Yeah.
Why can't university do 100,000 students when it's working with 10 different universities?
Yeah.
So, and with all the AI stuff that's happening at the back end, with those organic stuff, I think the question is, are there enough jobs?
Yeah.
Can you find those 100,000 jobs? And that's where the choice of the segment is such that those industries are growing. Like how many people would a Taj need or a Oyo need every year? Like we were just talking about it before this conversation. They need thousands of people. So I think the question is, can you execute towards it? And I don't think there's anyone other than Vivek who can execute to this vision.
We've seen that over the last 2 years. He has overachieved every number that he had mentioned 6 months back. So Vivek, what is the dream? What is the mission you're working towards?
See, there are both long-term and near-term lenses. I think if we talk about near-term, I think we are very, very reasonably happy the way things are going. These are those small stories that you hear every day from the cohorts of our learners who took a bet on us in early 2024. So that cohort is already out in the market doing internships. I'll give you a very interesting insight. So I come from Bihar, I would say a lower middle income class family. And then I remember there was a period, my father was a government servant, when he did not get his salary for 11 months straight. And we were three siblings, we were studying in public schools in a very small place called Jhumri Talaiya. That's an actual place, by the way, in erstwhile Bihar, now in Jharkhand. So my sisters were the first ones to be pulled out of private schools and sent to government schools because my father did not get a salary for a year. Because I was a boy, so I was the last one to be pulled out. But imagine most of the families in that segment, they don't even have the means to actually afford a 3 lakh rupee education. And now what gave me a lot of excitement was that last week I came to know about a learner from 2024, a 19-year-old girl in Ranchi. And she took our Operation Theatre Technology program last year. She is out in Ranchi interning in a hospital. And she very proudly messaged me that she is now bearing the cost of her own education and not taking a penny from her family. And she also mentioned that her neighbors now call her Nurse Didi. Actually, she's not technically a nurse yet, but I think that's a clear sign of success in the near term. So think whatever we are trying to do, I think it's clearly working. In the long run, as Rajat says, see, numbers will follow. It's a dramatically large market. Out of the 45,000 higher education institutions that we are trying to partner with and empower, I think. And by the way, he mentioned about LPU. Let me give you another stats on that. There are more than 100 universities in India which do upwards of $100 billion every year.
In revenue,
yeah. So basically, any university which is getting 15,000 admissions a year will clock more than 120.
So there is a large profit pool that exists.
There's a very large profit pool. So think of this market, $70 billion market, 45,000 incumbents. All these incumbents have proven monetization, have proven scale, but have not proven outcomes yet. Still, they weren't getting disrupted. Why? Because there's not a free market. Education as a subject is a regulated subject. And hence, there's a tremendous scope for a player like us to work with those incumbents and, let's say, help them enhance the outcomes of their products. And there is a clear intent, at least among, let's say, the top 20% of that pool. So long term, yeah, I don't see any reason why somebody will not build the largest edtech company in the higher education space. If you ask me honestly, we of course have a clear shot to that being the category leader as of this instant, but eventually I think the winner in edtech is going to emerge from the higher education segment.
Yeah. So let me just conclude this with like a final sort of word on just what had happened over the last 2 years, right? So obviously we've changed our name from Matrix Partners India to Z47. The 47 stands for 2047. Developed nation building was core to our thesis to say India is going to create this much value. And our job is to sit on the side and watch great founders like Vivek build it for us. But we are always questioning the premise of there is just a lot of young population in India. There's an employability gap. How does this sort of fuse together? It was really refreshing to hear Vivek's first principles take on, you know, intent matters, the outcome matters. You cannot design something just basis of paper and ticket size. And he came out with a contrarian bet on the way that he's designed the business, what customer to go after, how they pay for it, why a degree matters, why on-job training matters, and how technology can help scale. I think it's been incredible to see over the last 2 years just how the student outcomes, what I'm hearing from the student, just how fast the company's executed with excellence and all the lives that they're actually trying to create a positive impact on. As a final word, if there's any of you young operators out there keen to understand what execution excellence looks like and how you can execute at both speed and quality, come give a shout out to Vivek. He'd be happy to take you on the journey. It's an important journey and we are very, very excited to see what unfolds over the next
year.
And
thankful. Thank you for having us as part of the journey.
No, thank you for being day one investors. I mean, you saw it way before anyone else saw what we are trying to do.
I saw you.
Our job is easier.
Founders first, always.
Yeah, that was easy.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
If you like this episode of Zero to Infinity, there are so many more that you must check out. If you like Indian startup content, hearing about founder journeys, or knowing more about emerging sectors that we're investing in, Zero to Infinity is the channel that you need to subscribe to.